You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
I had this realization that I like to improvise. And when I first went out on tour with Testament, I was improvising the solos. And as people got to familiar with the album, you know, why don't you play the solo like on the record?
And, oh, yeah. Interesting.
And I realized, okay, that's part of the deal.
Welcome to another episode of 2020'd, where up is down and left is right, and Sonic the Hedgehog is on Nintendo and Mario is on Sega Genesis. I'm Benny Goodman, and welcome to my friends, my partners in crime, the people that have to deal and endure with me, as I've been aptly named, the Punisher, Siobhan Cronin.
We have to remind you of all the things you're doing wrong after every episode.
That's Siobhan speaking on behalf of everybody. And then we have Corey Pesa, who can also speak on behalf of everybody.
I didn't want to dub you the Punisher, but if you're going to do that yourself,
we'll take
Amy
it.
Amy did.
Yeah,
and this week we have a great guest. And I'm saying this, that it's not like a drug dealer where it's like, it's always great. You know, like, this is the greatest weed. This is the greatest coke.
I made that mistake in my first introduction.
This is the greatest metal / jazz, or should I say jazz / metal
Maz.
/ photographer /
Mataz.
co-host, not co-host. I mean, I guess he said he is bipolar in some ways with his music because he's jazz and metal. But Alex Skolnick of the Alex Skolnick Trio, which could mean he's like tripolar.
Sure.
Jazz polar.
Yeah.
Author polar.
Well, yeah, the guy does everything. He's got his own podcast, which is probably way more interesting than ours, but don't tell anyone. And he also, you know, we get to hear about that transition from being like in this iconic thrash metal band and then deciding, you know what, I'm going to go into jazz because that's a logical left turn that you can take.
Well, I'm fascinated by people that want to totally not change directions, but take on something new in the middle of life. And I think that's so admirable. You know, people that want to either write a book or go back to school. He talks about going back to school in New York and becoming a student really for the first time at a conservatory.
Can we also go on record as saying that he doesn't have a ghostwriter? So when he says he writes a book,
he writes
actually
a book.
Wrote a book.
Yeah, he writes.
And I asked him for a book. So Alex, can you please send me the book?
Alex, can you please sign my book? I'm like totally nerding out.
Let me
here.
Know what your Venmo is. I'll send it to you right now. It's cool. This is Alex Skolnick, part two. And if you have not already subscribed, tell him what's up, Siobhan.
2020-D.com. Go to the YouTube, wherever you listen to podcasts, everything. Just go sign up. Like it, subscribe it, follow us.
Please. Welcome back to another episode of 2020. My name is Corey Pesa. I'm here, as always, with our co-hosts, Siobhan Cronin.
Hi.
And Benny Goodman.
Shalom.
And super excited to continue our discussion with the one and only Alex Skolnick of, you know, Alex Skolnick Trio, Testament, Isaac Podcast, Moods and Modes, which I'm excited to check out soon. And
I
think the biggest thing to, you know, in his career so far, he's contributed some guest solos to Lost Symphony. That are, you know, I think going to really give you that, you know, you're looking for that like big boost in your career.
Well,
Alex,
Nuno now knows who you are.
It's going to happen now.
So like that's important.
but
I think we've met.
Yeah.
Does he know that? I'm just kidding.
I think so.
He's on his own planet sometimes. I think.
No, but
I love Nuno.
Been on a couple, we've done a couple events together. We did, we've done a couple like NAMM show things. We did a Randy Rhoads tribute together. That was really fun. With Rudy Sarzo on bass, which was like a big, he was become a good friend. And happy to, this turned out to be a fun thing. And yeah, you got me and Marty, you got me and Nuno, all of us together.
Something that actually, I'll tell you, that there's even more of a surprise, Alex. I don't want to say, it's preemptive of knowing that the Nuno Skolnick Marty collision happens. But when Ollie passed away, I hit up a bunch of his friends, and first I went to Marty because he was super into Marty. And I thought if there's ever a chance, maybe he'll care. And he was super nice. And we had the same PR and Marty's been nothing but just great to me.
Marty's great.
But I said to myself, I need to go to David Ellefson. Because David actually had talked about being in Lost Symphony when Ollie was still here, but he was just obviously busy being in Megadeth.
Yeah.
So when Ollie passed, Marty said yes. And then like 3 or 4 days later, David calls me and said, yeah, I'll do it. And I realized the only songs that were open were the songs with Marty. And I'm like, oh, this isn't good. And I called my PR friend who introduced me to Marty. And I was like, can I tell Marty that David's going to be on these songs? Like, how do I broach this? And she's just like, tell Marty. So I told Marty about Ollie. I told Marty what we were doing. I said, it'd be really awesome if you and David would play together. David is a huge influence of mine. And Marty writes this whole big thing about like, I don't want to be associated with any of that's going on, but my heart's not cold. And David is my brother. So we actually put Marty and David Ellefson on a few tunes together on this record as well. So if you and Nuno and Marty playing together were not enough, we did get David and Marty to play Nicey Nice on a song or two.
I've seen them play together even not that long ago.
Yeah.
One of the other projects I'm involved with is called Metal Allegiance. It's this all-star project that it performed by a friend of mine, Mark Menge, who also plays bass, but he and I have sort of become the overseers of the thing, and at least for the albums. And for the live shows, we've done a few tours, but we would play at the NAMM show every year at the House of Blues. And I think 2 NAMM shows ago, Marty was in town and we got Marty to play, and Ellefson is part of our core group, and they were all into it.
Well, it's funny you say that because we talked about that with Ellefson. And do you remember the first song they played together? It was a Metallica song, Alex.
Yeah.
And I actually asked them, was it the Four Horsemen? Which is funny on so many levels. Because we all know the Mechanics destroys the Four Horsemen.
Right, of course.
But needless to say, the first song that David and Marty played together, apparently, according to both of them, was Metallica, which just seems ironic on so many levels.
That's right. Yeah, because, and in fact, now that I think about that show, I remember we did a whole Metallica set. So, like, they did a song. I mean, it was like a 3-song set. It's a crazy show, Metal Allegiance. Like, we go from, like, you know, there's like a block. It was not a set, a block of Metallica. And they play, but then there'd be another lineup doing the next song, and then the next. And
I feel like Marty Friedman bending like Kirk Hammett would be really weird, because I don't think he could even, I don't want to say dumb down his playing, but for lack of a better term, dumb down his playing to sound like Kirk Hammett enough to make it passable as Metallica.
Yeah, no.
Hear Dream Theater play like Metallica, it doesn't sound like Metallica at all. It sounds like John Petrucci playing Master of Puppets.
Yeah,
right. Exactly. And I've played that stuff too. And I just I try to play it like me.
Do you play it in time, or do you play it in like the weird polyrhythm or whatever? Like 12. Do you speed it up?
I don't think about it.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Well, anyway, Alex, back to you for a moment. So on our last episode, we left off with kind of your transition, but sort of getting into jazz. And you started to tell us a little bit about that. I'm actually really curious to hear, how you got that interest coming from the metal world and what it was like learning jazz later in life. I just started taking jazz lessons myself, and I'm from the classical world.
Oh, cool.
And I think it's like it's so cool, and it's like the ultimate challenge of like every part of my brain. Coming from a different genre where it's, I'm sure there are similarities across all types of music, but I'm just interested to hear your experience and how that sort of happened and how you kind of carved out also a career in jazz at the same time.
Yeah, well, there's a number of factors to it. But I think part of it, I had this realization that I like to improvise. And when I first went out on tour with Testament, I was improvising the solos. And as people got to familiar with the album, you know, why don't you play the solo like on the record?
And, oh, yeah. Interesting.
And I realized, okay, that's part of the deal. They want
so none
those.
Of the early Testament stuff was composed. That was just like a take that you thought that was the good one, and every take could have been different.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, yeah, I might have had some themes or some parts, but yeah, I wouldn't.
It wasn't Randy Rhoads. I'm tripling this shit because I know every single note. It was like, no. I'm going to go in and this is how I feel, and that was the take, and boom, you're out.
Well, I would do a bunch of ideas and sort of settle on the best one. But once I play it live, I might say, okay, I want to play it as though I'm still developing as a player. So anyway, so I realized I liked improvising. I would do occasional jam sessions. When I wasn't on the road, I started sitting in with bands, and I got tired of playing the same songs, right? It was always, I realized I didn't, mm-hmm. I felt very limited. I'm like, okay, I know Sunshine of Your Love, Freeway Jam, Voodoo Child. I mean, these are all great songs, but I really want to improvise more. And then that was just one thing. And then right around the same time, I saw a Miles Davis concert on television, and he was playing with one of his electric bands. Now, I don't remember who exactly was in the band, but around this time period, he had, at different times, John Scofield on guitar, Robin Ford on guitar, Mike Stern, Marcus Miller on bass. It hit me as just like high energy, funky, bluesy music. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to learn jazz. I just totally dug this music. I was already into Al DiMeola, and some of the musicians on Al DiMeola records included Chick Corea, Jaco Pastorius. Yeah. So I was discovering all this music. And
can I stop you at Al DiMeola? I want to ask about him in particular because he's a dude that I feel like transcends so many people. So like, you know, we had Rusty Cooley on our record, you know, who's a speed demon and crazy player. Right. But then you hear all these other, you know, from all walks of life, but everyone respects Al DiMeola. Why?
Yeah, well, he's a really good example of like a link between jazz. You know, he's a different type of player. I think he's more influenced by like international music. You know, you can hear sort of flamenco
kind of,
type phrasing, even though even when he plays electric.
He totally listens to Steve Stevens. I know that's what it is. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, no. no, Paco de Lucia, I mean, who he has this
and
great
Segovia.
So Al DiMeola, he's like a link between all that stuff. So I was already into him. And through Miles, I discover all these other guitar players. I start going to hear John Scofield live when he plays. And I just realized, okay, I'm not done learning yet, you know, at this point. And I started studying with players who told me that, you know, these people you're listening to, they all know how to play jazz, even if what you're hearing may not sound like jazz. It's like it's built off of jazz, but you have to know how to play jazz to play it. So out of necessity, I started learning traditional jazz. I'm like, okay, I have to learn Charlie Christian, right? Who played with somebody named Benny Goodman.
I thought he was just a pickup.
Airmail special. Like I learned Charlie Christian stuff. Your stuff.
Sing for me, Alex.
Yeah. Yeah.
And were you taking lessons or was this mostly like self-taught exploration?
I took some lessons.
Okay.
I asked around. I found some teachers. I started to get it. I was just like, you know, it's actually really fun to play music that's completely different than what I play and not play through a wall of amps. You know, it's nice to just
right.
play. But that's why I listen to Frank Zappa. How about someone like that? You say jazz, but what do you think of someone like Frank Zappa?
There's a great completely different. I'm a huge Zappa file. I'm influenced by him both in the terms of being outspoken and just taking chances. I'm certainly not. I don't directly sound like him, but yeah, he's a huge influence. He's also got his own style, and I never really. It wasn't like a guitar style that I directly connected to. So, like, as far as like jazz rock guitarists, you know, certainly Pat Metheny was one. I keep mentioning Scofield, right? He's a good example. But there's a guitarist named Jimmy Herring, who's kind of well known in the jam band world, who's currently in Widespread Panic. But he was in a band called the Aquarium Rescue Unit, which is like one of my favorite bands of all time. Like, that's an incredible band. And actually influenced by Zappa, but the players in there are insane. O'Teal from the Allman Brothers was in that band originally. So I discovered them around the same time. But I also, like I said, I liked not being limited to just playing a loud guitar through a wall of amps, you know, taking like one of these guitars, like the L5, and plugging it into a small amp and playing along with a trumpet or a sax, you know, wow, what a concept, you know. Yeah. There's just so much more to music than just this one side of things. And it was kind of crazy. This all happened right before Testament went in to do our third record. So the third album was called Practice What You Preach, and it was recorded. It was our first album that we did on the West Coast, and the studio was a very well-known studio called Fantasy Studios that also had a record label that was in the same building, Fantasy Records. And this record company was buying out all these defunct jazz labels, right? Because at this time, this is like the end of the 80s, CDs are the new thing, right? Vinyl is being phased out. Old record companies are going out of business. So Fantasy Records is remastering all this jazz for CD. So while I'm in the studio recording this Testament album, I'm hearing all this jazz being remastered. And it was magical. Like, there was one session I heard, and they were remastering John Coltrane. And it sounded like he was in the room. They had it set up.
Wow.
So it sounded like a recording session. And I knew the name John Coltrane, but I had just never been like clobbered over the head with his music. And hearing it like that, it was the first time that I'd felt anything like when I first heard Van Halen very loud doing Eruption. It was like that kind of thing, like, whoa. You know, it was intense, it was spiritual, it was virtuosic, it was technical, it was going so many places. And I'm hearing this, and I can't see behind the door, and I like peeked in. I'm just, I gotta know, who is that? Who, you know? And he's not here. That's John Coltrane. Anyway, so that was like magical. And that was just one of many albums that they were remastering. And because I was a client of the studio, they offered to give me promo CDs of like anything I want.
Oh, wow. Nice.
They gave me a list. Yeah, we're mastering all this. Everything is going to have, you know, like hundreds of promo copies for radio and jazz press. We'll gladly just make a list. Some of these might cost $1. If, you know, but most of them are for free. So I ended up with like hundreds of albums. So that was my jazz. So it all, at this point, I'm starting to think, okay, you know what? There's a purpose to this. There's like, this makes sense. I don't know why, you know, I didn't get that music when I was younger, but I'm getting it now. And every time I go and hear a great concert, I went to hear McCoy Tyner. I went, I saw Herbie Hancock. So I'm like going to these concerts and I'm just getting completely knocked out.
Herbie Hancock, rest in peace. I can't even believe I'm saying that. My brain just went like,
well, I mean, to me, it was all music. And you mentioned Zappa before. That, what a great example of somebody that, you know, sort of brought together all these different types of music. And well, I thought, can we pause for one moment?
Because neither of these two have...
Herbie Hancock's still alive.
I think he's dead, isn't he? Is it one of those Snopes? I thought he had passed.
I just want to make sure we don't freak anyone out that's listening
Chick
or watching.
Chick Corea just passed away.
Right, Chick Corea did, yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. No, but I think I may have
Herbie
seen
Hancock
a
just gave a big
well, no, but when they do that, here's the thing with memeology. When people do Facebook or whatever, they'll say people are dead or that they just died from 5 years.
Right. That doesn't make it any time.
No, but, so I probably saw it and then just internalized, oh, poor Herbie Hancock. And then meanwhile, he's still alive. I just believe
it. That's so typical of today.
Cancel culture. I'm totally the problem.
I saw Peter Gabriel.
Herbie, I'm sorry.
Peter Gabriel was trending last month and I got all scared. I'm like, oh my God.
Oh my gosh.
Because he's over 70. Every time somebody over 70 is trending, I fear the worst. It was his birthday.
How about when Robert Fripp started trending? What did you think about that? I mean, as a guy that certainly knows Fripptronics, he's responding well to COVID, it seems.
I don't know. I have so much respect for him. I just saw King Crimson for the first time, right? One of the last big concerts I went to before everything shut down, and I went on tour. King Crimson played at Radio City Music Hall in New York, and it was amazing. And incredible. What a great artist. I don't really get, like, I get that he's having fun. It's a little odd. I kind of think it's like these videos him and his wife are doing.
Can we explain what they are? So for people who haven't seen them, you can go on YouTube. It may probably show up on your Google because of Alexa. But Robert Fripp, who's the guitar player from King Crimson, has a wife with big boobs. And she wears shirts that are very sheer. And then they do very strange covers of songs that you know. And they're odd. Very odd.
And they're very deadpan about it, too.
It's obviously probably how it happens.
And she's dancing, and they do like Metallica.
They own it.
Yeah, Sabbath. I understand. It's like they're having fun, but I kind of think it's the type of fun, like, send it to your friends.
Yeah.
Send it to.
They got millions of views, and more people probably know now who Robert Fripp is. We're talking about Robert Fripp. Who's talking about King Crimson? I love King Crimson because I'm a nerd, but like most people aren't like, King Crimson. Yeah, Robert Fripp, big boobs.
That could be.
That was ultimate derailment of the conversation. I'm sorry.
I apologize. To Robert Fripp, too, and his wife with big boobs. Yeah.
King Crimson. I mean, I got a lot of this music I hadn't been into when I was younger because when I started my professional career at 18, it was all about, you know, Scorpions, Ozzy. Then, like, just really that side of things. And over the next few years, I just really just opened up to a lot of this music. But when it came to, you know, like the straight ahead jazz, at first it was sort of out of necessity so I could better understand the kind of high energy electric jazz that I like. But then, you know, that experience hearing Coltrane being remastered and being gifted this whole collection of jazz albums by Fantasy Records, like, that just opened up this whole side. And then I really kind of went down this path it led me to moving to New York. That's one of the reasons I'm here now. I got a music degree from the New School. I always felt like I wanted to be able to study music at the university level, be able to relate to the type of musicians that I was listening to. And that was hard. It was really like starting over. You know how it is, because you're learning jazz, you know, kind of.
Sure. Well, I'm just going to university or like any conservatory style school. You're suddenly thrown into a pool of people that are from everywhere with all different backgrounds at a super high level. So I can imagine, yeah, especially coming from a different world, you know, where you've already had somewhat of a career and then you're starting something new.
It was really like starting over, but it felt right for some reason. And there's so much that I wouldn't have been able to do had I not done that, you know, like some of my own music with the trio and making charts. I didn't know how to do any of that. Musical situations where I've worked with piano players and horn players, you know, because I just, you know, I did, that wasn't a part of playing heavy rock, and that's fine. Some people just don't have an interest in that, but I wanted to experience more of music, and it made a lot of sense. And sure, eventually, the original Testament reunited, and like 2006 or so, and then this whole new later period came around. We've done 3 records in in the 2000s. The most recent one was last year, called Titans of Creation, and we were supposed to be touring for that right now. That the touring got derailed by COVID.
Yep.
You got 2020.
But the point being, at some point I wanted to go back to it. I was doing, you know, just there was a time period I was doing just mostly jazz, like 90% jazz. And then I started playing with the Trans-Siberian Orchestra, which you've heard of, which you have experience with. And
Siobhan played in the Trans-Siberian Orchestra.
Yeah, we must have overlapped. I did want to ask you about that.
Yeah, like, I was going to say, did you guys play together ever?
I don't know if we did. I played in the string section, so I would do kind of regional shows, and it differed every year. But, you know, again, also, I was on a way lower level of involvement than, like, the core band members. Right. So
what,
I was actually curious.
Area? What region?
I did mostly the East, but I didn't always go as far as New York. It would be like a lot of the Midwest shows down through Tennessee. I was almost always with the East Coast band.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, I was always with the East Coast band from 2000 to 2009.
Ah, that's why. I think my first shows were probably in like 2010 or 11.
Oh, okay.
So that makes sense.
We just missed.
That would have been really funny if you played like 100 shows together and you guys didn't
know. I definitely would have known, but I knew that this
so existed. You know, who's named the guitar player in the Trans-Siberian Orchestra lineup that you were in then, Siobhan?
So I played with Chris Caffrey, Joel Hoekstra.
Right. Joel came in right after I did.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, he was
so then
my
that makes
replacement.
Sense. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So almost all the shows I played were with Joel, unless it was the other one, which had...
that was Al and Angus.
Al Petrelli. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
So I started that in the early part of the 2000s, and that was sort of me getting back into the rock side of things, even though it was like this total theatrical production, especially back then, because it wasn't an arena show yet. It was theater.
That's interesting. Okay, let's talk more about it, because I was always curious about the earlier stages, because of course, you know, the string players, like when I came in, it was always arenas, you know, so it already developed to such a huge level by the time I first started doing it.
Yeah, I mean, the lineups were similar. There would be the same type of string section, pickup string section, depending on the region we were in,
right?
But instead of an arena, it would be a small theater, like in New York, it was the Beacon in Cleveland, wherever all the Broadway shows are in Cleveland, the theater district. I forget the name of the theater, but you know, every town has a little theater district. Pittsburgh, Philadelphia. So we would play those places. As it a few years in, it started to get more popular, and we would be there for several days. And just and then finally they decided, I think it was like 04 or 05, we're just going to book this into arenas and see what happens. And then it sort of blew up.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. But that got me, that kind of got me back playing like loud rock stuff. And then the band Lamb of God invited me to play a guest solo on their album. And they became good friends. And yeah, I sort of found my way back to metal through those things, but I decided, can we say thank you,
Lamb of God, for bringing Alex Skolnick back to metal? Like, can I let Mark Morton know? Like, thanks, dude, for bringing that dude back.
He knows. We've done a lot of shows together since then. And I think it would have happened, but they really helped it happen. And
they're a good catalyst.
A few other things too. But and then also Testament just deciding to get back together. They were kind of done. They'd kind of had a hard time in the 90s, the whole alternative music, modern rock era.
Yeah.
And then by the mid 2000s, they decided to just, when we got back together, it was going to be just like I was almost going to be like a farewell tour. We just decided we'll just do a few shows. We'll kind of retire the band. And at that point I decided I want to, I'll have my metal side, but I'll keep doing my instrumental stuff as well. But then, as Testament played more and more, like offers kept coming in. And, by 2 years into the reunion period, just when we thought we would be wrapping it up, we got this offer to tour with Heaven and Hell, which was Black Sabbath, fronted by the late great.
It goes on
Dio.
And on.
Yeah.
Yep. It's Heaven Judas and Priest. Hell.
Yeah, the Masters of Metal tour, it was called. Heaven and Hell, Judas Priest, Motorhead, and Testament.
Dude, when did that happen? Because I feel like I've seen Heaven and Hell every single... I went to Canada to see them.
2008.
Wow.
And of course, to do a tour like that, you need a product. Okay, I guess we have to go in the studio and do a record. So
thank you, Dio.
Yeah, that started the whole resurrection phase of Testament. And since
so it's
then,
like a rainbow in the dark for Testament.
Yes. And since then, it's been this interesting balancing act. I reconnected with Stu Hamm, the bass player. We're currently working on it. Somehow we never did a record together, but we actually started one last year. And we're going back in the studio in a few months. And I think we're finally going to have our album.
What's that going to sound like, Alex? Like you and Stu... Sound like that seems like there's a lot of like alpha crazy jazz going.
Oh, it's amazing. We connect much deeper than we did. Because when I played with him back then, I'd never done an instrumental tour before. I was totally an ear player. I didn't know how to work with charts. I knew basic theory from Satriani, but I didn't.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah. But I didn't know, it wasn't like now, and I didn't have like a whole catalog of instrumental compositions of my own to play. And now, it's like, I can bring in my own material. I can write, I know how to do that. I can compose material. I can write charts for everybody. It's a whole other level.
In the same realm, what about going back with Testament with all this, years of experience and knowledge. What was that? Yeah. How was that going, back to something that you're very familiar with from your past, but with this new perspective of music and theory and everything.
That took a little bit of time.
Yeah.
Not as much though. It was nothing like the process of learning jazz that involved sort of stepping away and kind of basically like going on a 10-year retreat.
Yeah.
yeah, that's what it feels like.
That's really
Are you sure it's not like an ayahuasca trip where you go like you're puking and shitting and seeing God and then coming back and you're like metal, thank God it's Maiden.
Yeah. No. So that metal, learning jazz guitar was like starting over. And then coming back to metal again, it was like at first, it was like okay. Remembering how to ride a bicycle.
Yeah.
But then, I just had so many more, I had so much more knowledge.
Right.
And it was very strange. And I had to control it. It was almost like
Yeah, like I feel like it would infiltrate like some of the jazz harmony, like even yeah, what little training I have in jazz, it's like hard to unhear.
So you go from being harmonic minor in a box to like there's non-diatonic notes going on. And you're like, but it's fine. They're just passing notes.
Yeah, I've since found a balance. Like I found a way to sneak it in. But at first I was experimenting and I tried some solos that just it was too much. There's like, you know, I knew I would listen back. And I realized I'm overdoing it. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, I think it's part of what kind of gives me some, my own quality. I think if I can say I have my own style, I know it's, you know, there's always going to be overlap, but I feel like in a lot of, with a lot of guitar solos and rock and metal, there's a lot of cut and paste parts. Like you could say, oh, this pentatonic lick, would, you know, I could take this and, you know, place it in another band's song and it would fit. It wouldn't be that different.
We've done, you know, 50 some odd episodes of this podcast and we've spoken with some amazing musicians and at the top of their game. And that's a theme that has come up over and over again, is that they just say, learn every kind of music in every kind of genre and just get as much experience and exposure as you can, because that's the only way you can be you and develop your own sound. Because if you only listen to one style of music, you're just gonna be regurgitating that over and over again. And it's no, right. It's not you. You know, what makes you you is all those different experiences.
Like,
and all those
for example, Alex, we were speaking to Shannon Larkin from Godsmack, and the Godsmackers, you know, are obviously a big, they're a Boston band, and I call them the Godsmackers. I'm sure Sully Ernest is calling
his
manager.
I was going to say, that manager. To Sully's face. I'd like
to
see that.
Yeah, well, I'm taller than him.
But, no, you're not.
Yeah, I'm not that much taller than him. Or his manager, who's one of my best friends. But he was saying, they're all blues guys. Tony, the guitar player for Godsmack, and Shannon are both diehard blues players. And even though Tony's an unbelievable metal guitar player that holds down the fort, he himself takes himself more seriously as a blues player. And, you know, Shannon and they have the Apocalypse Revival.
Blues Revival.
I'm high, Shannon. I'm sorry. But that's what he goes back. And when they go back to the Godsmack mode and have 4 number one hits, by the way, you know, they are coming back having played blues, immersing themselves in blues and not even being known by anybody in blues, but then going back and playing arenas as faceless musicians behind Sully Erna playing metal. And it's a different thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's great that they do that. You know, that, I think musicians should spread their wings. Paul Stanley is doing Soul Station right now, which is sort of this Motown themed.
Is it awesome or is it awesomely bad?
I haven't seen. I think it's getting good, decent reviews. And either way, he seems really happy to do it. He seems very passionate about it, and I think that's great. I mean, when I started branching out, first, you know, playing with Stu, and then you know, just really going off on this jazz tangent, people thought I was crazy. And then once the internet came along and comment sections, I mean, I was just a target of vitriol. Yeah, like,
wow,
like what did I do to these people?
Well, and like jazz is such like an elevated, I mean, I consider it, like we talk about this, that it is kind of like the ultimate level.
It
you
is,
know, so
but
I can't
also,
believe it.
It's the metal fan.
Basic
it's the same metal
like
fans, you know, that don't want to listen to anything that, you know, the guy wearing lipstick or makeup, you know, in the Bon Jovi,
yeah, like anything that's
very
different.
Metal
yeah.
fans are very dedicated to that, and if you stray away, I can totally see that reaction of like, wait, you're not
Look,
being faithful to the genre.
Today is the 35th anniversary of Master of Puppets, the last metal album that mattered. So fuck all of you, okay? That's the only thing that matters. That's what metal sounds like, and that's what your album should sound like forever. And if you make anything that doesn't sound like it, well, you're not Cliff Burton.
Yeah. Well, that was every case. Metallica record since then doesn't quite sound like that.
Nah, I know, that's quite. Why we're always let down, Alex. Tell them that. Yeah.
So, yeah, no, that's, I think it's changed. Luckily,
Yeah.
That's calmed down a bit. But yeah, the, for a while, yeah, you would think I like went and joined Poison or the Ricky Rocket review with
you and Poison. That was two Poison people in a row. They're actually nice people, you know. They're real people. CC's actually gotten good. That's the funny part.
It's a perfect, with respect to them, it's a perfect band to contrast with.
Yeah, right.
No, they were terrible, but I got to say that if you go see CC now, well, you can't see him, but I had seen him like a few years ago, and he was good.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what? You got, for that type of music, you know, obviously they wrote hits. They wrote a lot of songs that a lot of people like. Yeah. It's just not, for, that. Yeah. That is
he
one
was a
genre.
Celebrity Apprentice, Alex.
Right, yeah. Well, that's one genre I never really related to, was sort of the kind of sing-along, feel-good, ultra-commercial stuff. Like,
so you don't like Kiss?
Well, the 70s Kiss. The 80s Kiss is totally different.
But I want to rock and roll all night and party every day. Seems like I can sing along to it, Alex.
Yeah. Well, that was the 70s. That
it was okay in the 70s, but by the 80s, it was tired, is what you're saying.
Look at them in the 80s.
Rather not.
Well, they took off their makeup, and that was bad.
Exactly. And then they put on a different type of makeup.
Well, without getting too far away from music, I wanted to ask about your book and writing. Uh-huh. And, you know, before we run out of time, of course, at what point did you decide to write a book? I'm always interested in people that take up writing because it seems like such a daunting task to write, especially sort of a memoir. And, you know, how did you decide to do that? And where did you get the skill to write? How did you learn? It's just fascinating that you did this.
Oh, thanks. Well, I started around the same time I got into jazz. That same year that we did that Third Testament record and I was discovering all this new music, I got asked to write a column for a guitar magazine. Two guitar magazines, actually. They kind of reached out like right at the same time. And it was incredible. Guitar for the Practicing Musician, which isn't around anymore, and Guitar World. And I end up writing for both of them at different times. So I would do monthly instruction columns. And then that was the first time like I really had to put thought and energy into my words, because it's going to be read. It's going to be on newsstands, right? That it's just like, you know, it's like going on tour and having the incentive of a show. Like, you have to get it together. So, around that same time, I was reading a lot, and I just remember my the manager of Testament at that time. He'd been sort of he played Woodstock with the band Sha-na-na, which is like the 50s cover band. But he had been this, you know, part of the whole kind of late 60s, you know, fans of like the Beat writers and stuff like that. And he had just passed on all these books like Kerouac and, Tom Wolfe. So I started reading their books, and then eventually people like Kurt Vonnegut and John Updike, later Haruki Murakami, you know. So that became, as you know, especially with all the travel, that was just a great way, when you couldn't work on music, that was a great way to stay engaged. And so I developed a taste in good writing, and I always thought, well, you know, there's so many interesting things to write about that I'm experiencing, going from sort of being a kid at school that can barely talk to anybody to, you know, being on a heavy metal tour at age 18, and going from being kind of known for, you know, for this heavy, you know, thrash metal music, but developing an interest in jazz, and just, you know, just that whole process of developing and growing. At one point, I started doing a blog, and the blog sort of helped. The blog helped write the book in a way, because mm-hmm. every blog sort of became either a chapter or a section of the book. Most of the blog.
Interesting.
And then I would expand on the blog. Yeah, and I just thought, yeah, it was just something. It was something I always wanted to do. I'd been thinking about it way before it was common to do. And this is something I've learned over the years, is to try to, when I'm inspired to do something, try to do it sooner, because
sure.
this always
like
happens.
Podcasts. Anyway,
podcast, no, perfect example. I was thinking about doing this podcast in the 2000s. When it was a very new thing.
Our podcast or your podcast? Because that would have been really Nostradamus-like of you.
Both. But yeah, and now it's just, there are SNL sketches about people having podcasts.
Right.
And it was the same thing, like with the book. I'd been thinking about it for years. By the time I finally do it, musician book is not that new a thing, but I did feel like I would be able to do it in a way that was a little different. It's not, cause I had read, and I do know what I like to read, and I just tried to write it in a way that, okay, I think I would like to read this.
So let me ask you this. I'm going to throw some Kurt Vonnegut back at you. So he used to say that we are what we pretend to be. So we have to be careful what we pretend to be. Who are you pretending to be, Alex?
that's a tough question. Well, I'm not anymore, but I think at first, there was a sense, being just thrown into being like thrash metal guy. Mm. I'm thrash metal guy, and that's going to be my life, and I'm going to just totally be defined by that for the rest of my life. That was a...
you get an identity really fast when you're when you're put in a band and you're suddenly on the scene, of course. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I was never aware of terms like being boxed in or pigeonholed. Yeah. It just never occurred to me. I never understood why actors talk about that. Like, why they don't want to be typecast as a certain thing. And then at a certain point. But then when I emerged as a musician, I'm known for this very specific thing, which, I'm good at and I like, but I realized I was also being defined by the other people who do that music, that I really have, not all of them I have things in common with. I don't have the same background. I have other interests. I don't just listen to that kind of music, or so sort of breaking out of that and just being not being afraid to grow and be somebody different, even though the audience for that music, at least at the time, was just very purist in a way, which is one of the few things it does have in common with jazz, because has a base of purists.
Did you get any sort of response from the jazz community as you went back towards the metal realm?
I mean, the jazz community is, it's sort of like the rock community. There's just so many subgroups that have nothing in common with each other. But I got a lot of support, actually. Some of the teachers I studied with were these legendary artists, and they were just thrilled that I'd actually had experience in the school and I wanted to learn what they were doing. They were very encouraging and very cool about it. I'm sure I got some talking about behind my back, like, what the hell is he doing here? but I knew I needed to learn. And I knew I had to, I knew why I was there. I had no illusions. I didn't think, I'm going, here I am. I'm just going to be this master jazz musician. No, I was there to learn.
Right.
And over the time, I built up, by the time I did my first recording, I was shocked because I thought it's going to take like several albums. It's probably going to take another 10 years. But I did my first recording with my trio, and Billboard did a feature on it. Downbeat did a feature on it. Jazz Is, like all these magazines I never imagined being in. And it was incredible.
You think it's because you have awesome hair?
Probably doesn't hurt. Actually, no, I didn't amazing. At the time. When I did the first jazz stuff, I had very, very short. I was like, totally in kind of, I was finding my
your jazz
guitar,
persona.
So.
Yeah. Maybe we can get a little bit into your podcast and the topics that you tackle and how big of a part of what you're doing now is that podcast in comparison to the music.
It's a pretty big part. I mean, I could see doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
My original idea was to do piano jazz on NPR, but for guitar, right? And that piano jazz was the longest running show on NPR. Marianne McPartland, she would get together with another musician, usually a piano player, and they would talk about music and they would jam. So I started this with that in mind. And I did a few episodes with friends of mine, Nir Felder, who's a great player, Prasanna, who's a great player from India, and he sounds like a sitar or a veena player, but on guitar. And I got this great content of us talking about music and just jamming, and then everything shut down, and I had to find some extra angles. So I have done, in addition to these jam episodes, I have done like tributes to artists that we've lost. And sadly, there's been so many. You know, I did a tribute to Peter Green and Eddie Van Halen, who was such a big impact on me that
I feel like we should do one for Herbie Hancock right now in anticipation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, Ben, don't jinx it.
Yeah, please.
Sorry. Oh my God. And, please, no.
Well, there was another one. So I was talking about Stu Hamm. I went to record with Stu Hamm. We recorded at Sweetwater, you know, the music retail giant in Indiana. That they have a recording studio, and they had each of us do master classes. So I ended up recording that whole trip and just got a tour of Sweetwater, got the whole story, told the story of Sweetwater. So that was fun. That was like, you know, a travel episode.
Can you tell them to stop calling me about the picks I bought? Like,
and
yeah, 6 months
what's up
ago?
With the candy? I want to know why I have to get candy.
Like, listen to my episode. You'll find it. You'll find it.
I'm going to check it out.
Yeah. It's a variety. And, I was also, may he rest in peace, Anthony Bourdain.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, before he was on TV, I was reading him. Now he was another big influence as far as like writing a book, like his book about,
well, how depressing is it that he commits suicide? And like I used to say all the time, if I could be any person in the world and do any job, it would be Anthony Bourdain. Is to go to somebody's country, be ingratiated by the greatest people, at the greatest places, eat the greatest food, be like suave, smoke your cigarette, drink whatever the resident alcohol is, and then leave a dignitary. And like, and then he's dead. What is up with that, dude?
Yeah, we're gonna be wondering that a long time. Because I think a lot of people thought the exact same thing. But anyway, when he got on TV, like his shows were so great.
The best.
So I'm definitely inspired by his shows. I've even seen people leave reviews for my podcast saying this is kind of like an Anthony Bourdain centered around guitar.
Well, that's a great selling point. That made me way more interested. I just talked to you for 2 hours and I now want to go see, because I love Anthony Bourdain. I mean, I like Testament a lot. But Anthony Bourdain is like my fucking spirit animal, dude. So like, like Anthony Bourdain for guitar, I mean, besides the fact you got a 3-4-7 back there, like everyone's taking, if you are not watching on your television, your computer, or on your phone, take a look at Alex Skolnick's guitar collection. It's pretty awesome. And I also want to say thank you so much for playing on Lost Symphony with us, who is our sponsor. I guess the last thing I will ask you is, we are in an instrumental band. We've had to pivot this last year, 2020. Literally, we say we got 2020 into doing this.
Right.
For Ollie, we asked you, would you play on this? I guess I'm sort of curious. What did you think when you got to hear what people were going to hear as Chapter 3? Not knowing anything about this, because it is very, very, very different.
Yeah. No, I thought it was very... it is very different, but it's got a kind of a soundtrack quality at times, and then other times it's got, you know, the sort of rock quality, like majestic rock quality, and it's fun. Yeah, very different than the stuff I do. Very different than anybody would expect, and like the super shred guitar stuff works with it, but it's not dependent on it. There's parts where, you know, it gets quiet, and there's, you know, just lovely violin and piano.
That's Siobhan.
Yeah.
They say we sound like Trans-Siberian Orchestra, and it's like, well, I guess it makes kind of sense.
No, I think it's different. It's different. There's something organic about it, and I like that it's dynamic. It goes to these different places.
Well, we really appreciate having you on and you coming on our record, and certainly thank you, from our friend Ollie who listened to you night and day and stayed up all night with Angel Vivaldi talking about their favorite solos on your Testament records. Well, listen, man, those guys are now influencing a whole other generation. You know, obviously Angel Vivaldi is the first openly, gay shredder, I guess. I don't know what it, but he's amazing, and he's leading the way with Charvel. And then you know, Ollie. Oh, I don't feel like he got the due that he deserves because of kind of the ambiguity around his passing. But he was a composer, and as Frank Zappa said, if you want to be a composer in America, you might as well get your real estate license. Which, ironically, his wife has a real estate license. But it's so amazing to be able to have people of your level be able to play for Ollie, because Ollie was he was writing a book of scales when he passed. He had a bust of like literally Bach with crossed swords. It is like he was the real fucking deal, man. You know what I mean? So like I don't know if there's scales that aren't written that he should. I don't know if he's writing redundancies, but. The point is that the fact that you guys all came out and the fact that that was your response, I know wherever he is, he's going good.
Yeah, it's going to turn some heads. I'm excited for this to come out.
As are we.
That's awesome.
And
thanks for having me.
That said, Alex, thank you so much. It's been an absolute blast. Guys, check out his book. Check out the podcast, Moods and Modes, which I know I'm going
to
do probably.
I'm excited
as
to check it out. I'm going to finish this book.
I'm going to hijack it right now. So listen, can I ask you a favor? I want the book, but can I buy it from you? Because Siobhan makes fun of me because I collect first edition signed books by all the artists. And then she says I don't read them. But I want to read your book. So can I buy it from you personally so you can write like, fuck you, Ben, read this? And I actually will read it so I can talk to Siobhan and we can have a book club.
Sure.
That means a lot to me.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Sounds great.
Thanks, Siobhan.
Alex.
And you've been 2020.
We'll throw
please
up links to all your stuff.
And go check to Alex. AlexSkolnick.com. Alex Skolnick. His podcast, his book, Testament, the Alex Skolnick Trio, his 7,000 side projects, the writer, the man, whatever
the
he pretends to be.
The philosopher, the musician,
he's
the composer.
Become that.
You guys, the music is so like dramatic and intense. I think people have no idea like this side of you, this just wacky Tommy.
I'm pretty sure our label's like good.
There's a reason you have like four personalities, so
yeah.
Depends on what time of day.
I know how it is.
Well, thank you so much, Alex. So much. We really, really appreciate it.
All right,
you
guys.
Stay in touch and stay safe.
Really
man.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, as always, for checking out this episode of 2020. Please visit 2020-D.com. Like and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out on future episodes. This week's throwback clip is from episode number 59, featuring Paul Haber, TV producer and investigative journalist. Check it out.
You know, we took a helicopter and did some aerial shots, and things didn't go as planned. Things went wrong, and we crashed. And I survived.
Oh my gosh.
What was that like? Like, can you tell us like how did you know things were fucking wrong?
You know what? That's something that your brain just like pops out. Like it just, I remember up until the time where you know something's going to go wrong and then your brain just shuts down until the next thing I remember is I'm on the ground in the weirdest position in like a tremendous amount of pain. And I remember being pulled out by firefighters. And then I woke up the next, in probably a few days later than that, in really bad shape.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.